Hello, this is William Fink of Christogenia.org, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, February 7th, 2025. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. I don't believe how quickly the whole world, this time is passing this year and last and. Maybe it is just because I'm getting older. This is part 21 of our commentary on Isaiah, and it's titled The Burden of Tyre. I will pronounce it Tyre, I hope, throughout the entire program. Sometimes I lean towards pronouncing it here, but that's because the Hebrew spelling is actually Taurus, Turos. I'm sorry, the Greek spelling. The Hebrew spelling is Tsor, tesor, but the Greeks usually didn't follow that, and they made it either a C, I'm sorry, an S or a T, and that's how we have the words both Syria and Tyre are from that word, that Hebrew word Tsor, tsor. If I could say tsor and pronounce that T in there. The Greeks evidently couldn't, so that's why we have Taurus or Tyre. Actually, one of my favorite poems is from Rudyard Kipling, and it's called Recessional. And he made Tyre rhyme with fire, so I have some modicum of support for that translation. Okay, this is the Burden of Tyre. Since Isaiah chapter 13 and the Burden of Babylon, the prophet has announced an entire series of burdens against what may be considered to have been the world of ancient Israel at this time in history. With the death of Ahaz in the first few years after Hezekiah had become king of Judah, that's where we are at. In the course of these burdens, I'm sorry, there goes my throat again. This doesn't happen all week. In the course of these burdens, there is no mercy for Babylon, nor for the king of Babylon. But there is mercy for the Israelites in the burdens of Moab and Damascus. There was also mercy for the Israelites of the land shadowing with wings, which are evidently those of the Assyrian deportations who were portrayed as making a future supplication to God. Then there were the expressions of hope and mercy for the people of Judah who would flee into Egypt, although they would suffer for having done so, and plausibly also for those who would flee into Arabia. However, in the course of those burdens, there was no hope or mercy extended to the Egyptians, Ethiopians, Edomites, or Arabians. Then finally, in the Valley of Vision, which was an oracle against Jerusalem, there were continued expressions of hope for the people of Judah in the face of an ominous condemnation, even if that hope is expressed enigmatically in the promise of the Key of David. Now we come to the final burden of the series, and it is the burden of Tyre. Even though Tyre itself is condemned, as Jerusalem had been, there are still messages of hope and mercy for at least a portion of its people, as we shall see here in our discussion of Isaiah chapter 23. Now, discussing the burden of Tyre, we must first make an insistence that the Phoenicians of the Judges and Kingdom periods of ancient Israel certainly had been Israelites, at least for the most part, in spite of the general assistance of modern Jewry, which sways modern academia, that they had been Canaanites. They were not Canaanites. But on most Bible maps, which are published today, a land labeled as Phoenicia is demarcated in a manner where it appears to have been separate from the land of the tribes of Israel. But that is not true. And every Bible map which has done so has perpetuated a lie which is contrary to the actual text of Scripture. The evidence of this is seen as early as Judges chapter 5, where in the Song of Deborah, the prophetess had lamented that Gilead abode beyond Jordan, east of the Jordan, and why did Dan remain in ships? Asher continued on the seashore and abode in his breeches. The word for breeches in that verse is mitphrats, which Strong's defined as a break in the shore, i.e. a haven. Jesenius defined it simply as a port. Unfortunately, most of the book of Joshua is wanting in the Dead Sea Scrolls. However, in the Septuagint, in Joshua chapter 19, we read that the borders of Asher included Tyre, and where the inheritance of Naphtali is described, that tribe had inherited the walled cities of the Tyrians in Joshua chapter 19, verse 35. In verse 29, where it says that Asher had, the inheritance of Asher had included Tyre, the versions of Symmachus and, in verse 35, where it says that Naphtali had inherited the walled cities of the Tyrians, the versions of Symmachus and Aquila of Sinope support that reading, as well as the Old Latin, Origins Hebrew, and the Latin Vulgate. They all support that reading that the tribe of Naphtali had inherited the walled cities of the Tyrians. In verse 29, the text of the Septuagint states that their going forth shall be to sea, or in the King James Version, the outgoings thereof are at the sea, in reference to the borders. And at least some commentators and dictionaries suppose that the verse references the Sea of Galilee, which is disingenuous, because the eastern border of Asher was with Naphtali and Zebulun, and it wasn't even close to the Sea of Galilee, or properly in the Old Testament period, the Sea of Kinneroth, as it was called. Rather, the sea was the western border of Asher, the Mediterranean Sea. In verse 29, I missed one line of my notes. The reading found in verse 29 that Asher includes, the territory of Asher included Tyre, is supported by Symmachus. The reading is the same in his version, but not quite in the Masoretic text. So Symmachus supported the reading in the Septuagint, and Symmachus and the Keeler of Sinope had translated their translations of Hebrew, the copies of the Hebrew which they possessed, into Greek by the 3rd century AD, before the time that Arjun had made his hexapla. So he used their versions and set them alongside the Septuagint, along with Old Latin, not Jerome's Vulgate, but older translations of Latin which had already existed before Jerome, and his own version of the Hebrew. So the fact that the Israelites possessed the cities of the Tyrians as part of their inheritance should be undisputed, except that you won't find it in the King James Version or in any of the versions which are solely based on the Masoretic text. But these versions of which I speak all predate the Masoretic text by at least 800 years. The earliest copies of the Masoretic text which we have available today, they predate them by at least 800 years. Okay. As a digression, the fact that the Tyrians were Israelites, as a digression, this is how Anna, a woman of the tribe of Asher, who is mentioned in Luke chapter 2, had retained knowledge of her ancestry and had been in Jerusalem in the temple at the birth of Christ. Because Asher was never completely removed from Tyre by the Assyrians or Babylonians, or even by the later Greeks who had destroyed the island city. The Babylonians had only destroyed the mainland portion of Tyre, but they had never destroyed the island city. When Alexander did destroy it 250 years later, it is evident that by then many of the inhabitants had spread back to the mainland in the Persian period. In several ways, Tyre was a benefit to Persia in its war against the Greeks. We'll mention that again a little later. After the Judges period, as Solomon ascended to the throne of Yahweh to rule over Israel, we read in 1 Kings chapter 8, and at that time Solomon held a feast, and all Israel with him, a great congregation, from the entering in of Hamath, and we will define that phrase a little later, unto the river of Egypt, before Yahweh our God, 7 days and 7 days, even 14 days. I don't know why it's written like that. I thought I may have made a mistake for 7 nights. No, 14 days. This describes Israel as having inhabited all of the coasts of Phoenicia. Hamath was a notable port on the Orontes River, which runs from the north from the into the Mediterranean from the south. From south to north, it actually goes north of the latitude of Hamath and empties into the Mediterranean above Hamath. So Hamath was a notable port on the Orontes River, and the entering in of Hamath was the point where the Orontes River empties, because it's still there, into the Mediterranean Sea so that ships could travel to Hamath. That's the entering in of Hamath, the point at the Mediterranean where ships could get to Hamath by sailing up the Orontes River. Then even later, speaking of Jeroboam II, who ruled Israel for nearly the entire first half of the 8th century BC. In 2 Kings chapter 14, we read, he restored, and this is about the fourth or fifth time I've cited this passage in this Isaiah commentary, but it's just necessary. I'm sorry. He restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath under the Sea of the Plain, according to the word of Yahweh God of Israel, which he spoke by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was of Gath-Hepher. For Yahweh saw the affliction of Israel, and that it was very bitter, for there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And Yahweh said that he would not blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might, how he warred and how he recovered Damascus and Hamath, which belonged to Judah for Israel, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? The Sea of the Plain could only describe the Mediterranean Sea in that context, and it shows that Judah had possessed the coasts in the days before Jeroboam II. They had been lost to the Assyrians, as we have discussed earlier in this commentary, and it's not in my notes, but it's in a link in my notes. In part 10, speaking of Assyria, it may be contested that Hiram of Tyre had been called a king even before David had become the king of Israel, as it is recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 5. But there was nothing in the law which would prevent a ruler of a clan from acting as a king over his people in the time of the judges. In Exodus chapter 18, we read, And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. That the people kept this tradition as is apparent as late as the time of Solomon in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. However, once David became king, where it was only a few decades since all of Israel had first had a king, we read in 1 Samuel chapter 5, and Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David, and cedar trees, and carpenters, and masons, and they built David a house. He didn't have to do it. And David perceived that Yahweh had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. So there, it must be realized that it was Hiram's acknowledgement of David as king which had led David to perceive that Yahweh had established him king over Israel. Hiram and his sons had subsequently served both David and Solomon after him. Therefore, before and during the time when the Greeks had first begun to use the word Phoenicia to describe the coasts of the land which had belonged to Israel, it was inhabited by the Israelites. While some Canaanites had remained in Sidon, as the scriptures describe, they were in servitude to the Israelites. They were enslaved. And Israelites had also dwelt in Sidon. But wherever there were descriptions of the places where the Israelites had failed to drive out the Canaanites, which are found in Judges chapters 1 and 3, and elsewhere, while Hamath is mentioned in Judges chapter 3, the land as far as Hamath was later secured for Israel by David, which is described in 2 Samuel chapter 8. In Judges chapter 1, we learn that the Canaanites had remained in Sidon and in several other towns in Asher, but ostensibly, Canaanites had not remained in Tyre. And as the time progressed from Joshua to David, the Canaanites were gradually reduced in the land, as the scripture also explains in those chapters. Or I should say, perhaps, in those books. Where Joab conducted the census of the time of David, among all the other places he had counted Israel, he went to both Tyre and Sidon, 2 Samuel chapter 24. According to the Greek geographer and historian Strabo of Cappadocia, the people of the Phoenician colonies of the West had recollections of Tyre and not Sidon, where he had written in his geography in Book 16. Now, although the poets have referred more repeatedly to Sidon than to Tyre, and he makes the remark that Homer does not even mention Tyre, he says that yet the colonies sent into Libya, meaning Carthage, and Iberia, as far even as outside the pillars of Heracles, which are basically what we would call the Straits of Gibraltar. He said that they hymn rather the praises of Tyre. In other words, all those colonies in Western Europe, those Phoenician colonies, they sing the praises of Tyre and not Sidon. Ostensibly, Homer did not mention Tyre because he was writing in the context of the Trojan War, which had evidently taken place in the opening years of the 12th century BC. And by that time, Tyre was not yet a notable city. According to Flavius Josephus, in Book 8 of his Antiquities, now that year on which the temple began to be built was already the 11th year of Hiram. But from the building of Tyre to the building of the temple, there had passed 240 years. If Solomon came to rule around 970 BC, which is reasonable, then Tyre was built around the same time as the Trojan War. That's why Homer didn't mention it. But there is evidence that Tyre was much older than that. And in that same place, Strabo had called Tyre the largest and most ancient city of the Phoenicians. However, Strabo's statement that Tyre was the largest city does not necessarily mean it was the largest in ancient times. And Josephus may have been referring to the building of the island city, or even to a rebuilding or an expansion of Tyre, as it was known to the ancient Israelites. In any event, Phoenicia is only a geographic description, which was evidently coined by the ancient Greeks on account of the purple dye for which the coast was noted. The word is derived from a genitive form of the Greek word phoinis, which is blood red. But like the related appellation phoenix, or phoenix as we pronounce it, it may also mean crimson or purple. As a name, phoenix also described a notable Phoenician. But there it may be noticed that the meaning of the appellation is also the same as the Hebrew term Adam, although the Hebrew word cannot be substantively proven to be the origin of the use of the term among the Greeks. In Greek mythology, Phoenix was the brother of Cadmus and Kelix, the sons of Agenor, an ancient king of Tyre. Kelix had given his name to Kilikia, according to the myths, while Cadmus was the legendary founder of Thebes in Greece. According to the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus, Cadmus, along with Danaus the Egyptian, who also settled in Greece, had been in Egypt with Moses and the Israelites before the time of the Exodus. This Cadmus, often called the Phoenician, was also often credited by Greek writers, ancient Greek writers, as having brought arts and letters to Greece. Why do Greeks use the Phoenician alphabet, or the Hebrew alphabet, as it should be called? The mythical Europa, a woman for whom it was said that Europe was named, is described sometimes as the daughter of Phoenix and sometimes as his sister. Ancient Greeks, she might have been both. No, I'm just kidding. While these are only a few of the points we may raise to support our assertions, it is fully apparent that in ancient times there were close connections in ancient history between the Greeks, the Phoenicians, and the Israelites. Therefore, once we understand that the Phoenicians of the periods of the Judges and the Davidic kingdom were primarily Israelites, we would also posit the notion that in many ways, the scope of the prophecies concerning Tyre also relates to all of the Israelites who had gone through Tyre to settle in distant places. And we shall see that here in the later verses of this chapter. These Israelites would have left on the ships of Tarshish, as the Phoenician shipping industry was known throughout the Old Testament, at least from the time of Solomon, as it is recorded in 2 Chronicles chapter 9. So where Isaiah's burden for Tyre had opened, there was an immediate reference to the ships of Tarshish. Therefore, we shall commence with Isaiah chapter 23, with verse 1. The burden of Tyre. How, ye ships of Tarshish? For it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in. From the land of Kittim, it is revealed to them. Tarshish is listed among the sons of Javan, the son of Japheth, in Genesis chapter 10. With all certainty, Tarshish may be identified with Tarsus in what is now southeastern Spain. The other sons of Javan may be identified with various places in the Mediterranean Sea, and Javan himself is the eponymous ancestor of the Ionian Greeks. Borrowing a paragraph from part 14 of our Genesis commentary titled The Japhethites, there we had explained that the 5th century BC Greek historian Herodotus is writing about a period much earlier than his own, even predating the Trojan War. And speaking of Tarsus in southern Spain, he wrote, "This trading town was in those days a virgin port, unfrequented by the merchants." The Trojan War was about 200 years before King Solomon Chev's. So Herodotus certainly seems to have been accurate. And his having referred to Tarsus as a trading town helps to illuminate the scriptural record. In their intermediate Greek-English lexicon, Liddell and Scott readily identify Tarsus as the Tarshish of Scripture. But the Carthaginians could only have come to political control of Tarshish at a much later time, as Diodorus Siculus described, between the wars between the Carthaginian Hamilcar Barca and the Iberians and Tartessians in the 3rd century BC. We will make another mention of them from Livy quite soon, but I won't go into detail there. The Iberians were also Phoenicians, but not necessarily subject to Carthage. Evidently, Carthage and at least many of the other Phoenician colonies in the Mediterranean had remained loyal to the Tyrians until Tyre was destroyed by Alexander the Great before the end of the 4th century BC, probably around 330 BC. According to Flavius Josephus in his treatise Against Appian, where he had attested to have followed the ancient chronicles of Tyre, which are now lost, therein it was recorded that the temple was built by King Solomon at Jerusalem, 143 years and 8 months before the Tyrians built Carthage. So Carthage was apparently founded sometime around 820 BC. Kittim is also listed as a son of Javan in Genesis chapter 10. As we had explained in that very same commentary, both Elisha and Kittim are identified with the island Cyprus, perhaps, if you will, with several varying spellings of these names found in ancient Greek inscriptions. Cyprus is actually spelled K-U-P-R-O-S in Greek. Kupros is how I would pronounce that. Kittim is the word for Cyprus throughout the Hebrew prophets. Among several inscribed ostraca discovered in Arad, a biblical town in the south of Judah, which are dated to the period before the destruction of Jerusalem by the Chaldeans, we read, "To Eliashib, and as of now, give the Kittim 3 baths of wine and write the exact date. And from what is left of the old wheat, grind up 1 core of wheat to make bread for them. Serve the wine in punch bowls." And apparently this Eliashib was a servant and was expected to accommodate guests from Kittim. However, in later times, Cyprus had also been colonized by the Phoenicians. In book 9 of his Antiquities, Flavius Josephus had described a revolt of the Cyprians against Tyre, as the Phoenician colonies of Cyprus had been subject to Tyre before the Assyrian conquest of Israel. The Lamentation of Tyre in Ezekiel chapter 27 elucidates the fact that Tyre was an Israelite city. Yahweh wouldn't lament Canaanites in the first place. Throughout that chapter of Ezekiel, all of the sons of Javan were identified with the trade with Tyre. But in verse 6 of the chapter, people from the tribe of Asher are described as dwelling in Cyprus, or Kittim. In verse 12, the tribe of Dan, referring to Danan Greeks in this context, those same Greeks that went with Danos to Greek, brought trade according to the myth. I think the myth just represents that Danan Greeks came to Greece, not necessarily with a man named Danos, but that's according to the myth. The Danan Greeks brought trade to Tyre along with the tribe of Javan, the Japhethites, who were Ionian Greeks. The Septuagint has a line in verse 18, which is not found in the versions translated from the Masoretic text, which reads, "And wool from Miletus, and they brought wine into thy market." Miletus was an ancient Phoenician settlement in southwest Anatolia. Thales of Miletus was a famous early Greek philosopher who was said to have been of Phoenician descent by Herodotus once again. However, while the translations of Aquila and Symmachus have that line, they both had the wool as having come from a place other than Miletus, upon which they do not agree. And sometimes I'm convinced that that actually reflects a corruption of early manuscripts. Returning to the text of Isaiah, we shall read the first verse once again. "The burden of Tyre, howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in. From the land of Kittim it is revealed to them." And of course, the ships of Tarshish sailing from other points in the Mediterranean would reach Kittim first and probably stop there for the night, if not for a longer period of time, before moving on to Tyre or Sidon or whatever their next stop is on the Phoenician coast. So they would learn of the fate of Tyre when they had reached Kittim. The reference that it is laid waste must be referring to Tyre and not to Tarshish or Kittim. For reason that it is destroyed, there is no house and ostensibly no port. But the destruction of ancient Tyre is not mentioned in the historical books of Scripture, although it is also prophesied in other books of the prophets. Tyre is lamented in Ezekiel, along with its king. In Amos, whose prophetic ministry had surely run its course by this point in the ministry of Isaiah, we read in Amos chapter 1, "Thus saith Yahweh, for three transgressions of Tyrus." Don't ask me why the King James Version spelled it that way. Sometimes, only sometimes. "And for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom," which seems astonishing on the surface, but it's really not. As we proceed, we will learn why or how. "And remembered not the brotherly covenant," which proves they are Israelites. Canaanites couldn't have a brotherly covenant with Israel. "But I will send a fire on the wall of Tyrus, which shall devour the palaces thereof." So this also demonstrates that the Tyrians were of Israel, as they were part of the brotherly covenant with the Israelites. But during the time of the divided kingdom, and yes, the old covenant is a brotherly covenant because it's only for one tribe of people. But during the time of the divided kingdom, there had been divisions between Judah, Samaria, and Damascus. And as Assyria had begun invading the lands to the north of Ephraim. The Tyrians, as well as the rulers of other cities, fell tribute to the Assyrians. Therefore, those cities were necessary allies of Assyria and contributed to its wars with both money and troops, including the wars against Samaria and Judah. This we shall discuss with verse 2. Be ye still, ye inhabitants of the isle, thou whom the merchants of Sidon, sometimes it's spelled with an S in the King James Version, sometimes with a Z, and that's also awfully annoying. Sidon was a word, however, that was just like the Hebrew word for Tyre, where it began with the Hebrew letter tsadi, which is a TS that the Greeks didn't have. So sometimes the King James translators spelled it with an S and sometimes with a Z to reflect the TS. Be ye still, ye inhabitants of the isle, thou whom the merchants of Sidon that pass over the sea have replenished. The isle may refer to Cyprus or to the island portion of Tyre. The Sidonians would also have been Israelites. However, it is evident throughout the scriptures that in Isaiah's time, there certainly had been Canaanites among them. At least some of the merchants may have been Canaanites, especially in the later time of the divided kingdom. But the Canaanites of Sidon were slaves in the days of David and Solomon, and they would ostensibly have remained slaves throughout the time of the divided kingdom, except that the politics of the period are not always clear. If they were slaves when the rulers of Sidon had submitted tribute to the Assyrians, they would have very likely remained slaves while Sidon was a willing tributary. While the scripture focuses on the division of Israel and Judah, during most of that period, the northern 10 tribes would have been united under the king of Israel at Samaria. But once the Assyrians encroached upon Israel, the kings of Tyre and Sidon had split with Samaria and showed their allegiance to the Assyrians and gave tribute, while the kings of Israel had revolted. So as early as the time of Tiglath-Pileser I, who had ruled Assyria in the very late 12th and early 11th centuries BC, towards the end of the Judges period of Israel, we read in part in one of his inscriptions, I conquered the entire country of Amuru, and throughout Assyrian inscriptions, all of the land east of Babylonia was considered Amuru. All of Palestine was considered Amuru because at one time the Amorites had dominated that land. I received tribute from Byblos, Sidon, and Arpad. A century later, as scripture describes, David had taken those places as far north as Hamath. Then about 200 years later, after the time of David and Solomon, and perhaps around the time that Ahab was king of Israel, in an inscription from the reign of Ashurbanipal II, in an inscription from the reign of Ashurbanipal II, who was said to have ruled Assyria in the early 9th century BC, at the time of Ahab, we read, the tribute of the seacoast from the inhabitants of Tyre, Sidon, Byblos, Mahalata, Mesa, Kaza, Amuru, and I don't know where those three towns are, and of Arvad, which is an island in the sea, consisting of gold, silver, tin, copper, copper containers, linen garments with multicolored trimmings, large and small monkeys, betrays a trade with Africa here, ebony, boxwood, ivory from walrus tusk. Thus ivory, a product of the sea, this their tribute I received, and they embraced my feet. Walrus tusks. I don't know where the closest walruses are, but the Phoenicians did have settlements in Cornwall, in Britain, and probably points further north than that, I'm sure. A short time later, in the reign of his successor, Shalmaneser III, Ahab was described in another inscription as having sent 10,000 foot soldiers to join a coalition in battle against the Assyrians. So, in a later inscription of the same king, from the 18th year of his rule, he describes having defeated a large army which had been sent against him by Hazael of Damascus, and said, at that time I received a tribute of the inhabitants of Tyre, Sidon, and of Jehu, son of Omri. Then, in another record from a few years later, we read, in my 21st year, I crossed the Euphrates for the 21st time. 21 campaigns in 21 years, all of them west of the Euphrates or south, depending on your perspective. I marched against the towns of Hazael and Damascus. Four of his larger urban settlements I conquered. I received tribute from the countries of the inhabitants of Tyre, Sidon, and Byblos. It was Jehu who had cut off the house of Ahab, and therefore the house of Omri. But the Assyrians had begun considering all of Israel as the house of Omri, and they evidently did not know in detail the internal history of Israel. So they didn't know Jehu was really what, in their eyes, would have been a usurper, right? He would have, from outside, the outside point of view, Jehu would have usurped the throne of Israel. So this should serve to substantiate our assertion that even though Tyre and Sidon were Israelite cities, they did not remain united with Samaria during the entire period of the divided kingdom. Furthermore, they remained tributaries of Assyria throughout the time of the destruction of Samaria and Judah, so siding with Assyria against their own Israelite brethren, they were regarded as having remembered not the brotherly covenant by the prophet Amos. In the later days, Tyre remained a tributary to Tiglath-Pileser III. And in a fragmented, undated inscription from his reign, we read in part, and I'll just add that Tiglath-Pileser III, we've mentioned him a lot in these commentaries. He was the king of Assyria until about 727 BC and died around the same time as Ahaz had died, within a year. So in an undated inscription from his rule, we read in part, I sent an officer of mine, the Rabsak. Now, the translator has a question mark because the word may not be complete for some reason in the inscription, so he's kind of guessing at it. I sent an officer of mine, the Rabsak, to Tyre, and received from Metenna of Tyre 150 talents of gold, which is no small sum. That's a considerable amount of gold. While the reading of Rabsak had been marked as uncertain in the translation, it correlates to the Rabsaka or Rabshaka sent as an envoy by the Assyrians in the time of Hezekiah, who was described in 2 Kings chapter 18 and Isaiah chapter 36. Further on in the same inscription is another reference where we read in part, the words of Tiglath-Pileser III, I received tribute from Kushtashbi of Commagene, Rezan of Damascus, Menahem of Samaria, Hiram of Tyre, and Sibiti-Bili of Byblos, among other places. It goes on to mention Hamath, among several other places further north. Then much later, in the same inscription in which Sennacherib or Sennacherib had recorded the siege of Jerusalem at the time of Hezekiah, we read in part, and this is Sennacherib, "In my third campaign, I marched against Hatti," that's the capital city of the Hittites in Anatolia. "Luli, king of Sidon, whom the terror-inspiring glamour of my lordship had overwhelmed, fled far overseas and perished." "The awe-inspiring splendor of the weapon of Asher, my lord, overwhelmed his strong cities, such as Great Sidon, Little Sidon, Bitzidi, Zaribtu, Mahaliba, Ushu." Ushu is the name, the Assyrian name, for the mainland settlement of Tyre, the mainland city of Tyre. "Akzib and Akko. All his fortress cities, walled and well provided with feed and water for his garrisons. And they bowed in submission to my feet. I installed Ethbaal upon the throne to be their king, and imposed upon him tribute due me as his lord to be paid annually without interruption." In that inscription, the Akzib, which was mentioned along with Tyre, is certainly the Akzib, which was the border of Asher opposite the sea in Joshua chapter 19 in verse 29. But here Tyre was called Ushu, which was the Assyrian name for the mainland portion of ancient Tyre. The Egyptians had called the mainland city by a similar name, transliterated as Uzu, U-Z-U, instead of U-S-H-U, in their inscriptions. This may suggest that both the Assyrians and the Egyptians were familiar with the mainland portion of Tyre in more ancient times, and not so much with the island, which the Assyrians had evidently called by its Hebrew name, and not by any other strange name like Ushu. Even later, in an inscription of Esarhaddon, we read in part, "I conquered Tyre," which is an island amidst the sea. He didn't really conquer it militarily. "I took away all the towns and the possessions of Balu, its king, who had put his trust on Tirhaka," just like the Israelites were warned about going to Egypt for help, "king of Nubia," and that in Assyrian inscriptions. In the inscription, it says Khusu. So in the translation says Nubia, the Assyrian word is for Cush, which of course should be distinguished from Nubia, but the translators all follow the Jews. I can't help their errors. So it is evident that Tyre had remained a submissive tributary of Assyria throughout the time of Sennacherib's siege of Jerusalem, but sometime later must have revolted, resulting in the actions of Esarhaddon, which were described in this inscription. But a short time later, Tyre revolted from him once again. And in a later inscription, we read in part, "I crossed the Tigris and the Euphrates at the time of their flood. I advanced over the difficult territory of my route as quick-footed as a wild ox. In the course of my campaign, I threw up earthwork for a siege against Balu, king of Tyre, who had put his trust upon his friend Tirhaka, king of Cush." He says Nubia, but the translator says Nubia. I'll say Cush, and that's the Assyrian. "And therefore had thrown off the yoke of Asher, my lord, answering my admonitions with insolence." That's the king of Tyre rebelling against Esarhaddon. "I withheld from them," the inhabitants of a besieged Tyre, "food and fresh water which sustain life," because Tyre was an island city. It needed to be able to get those things from the mainland. again, even later, in the time of Ashurbanipal, king of Assyria. Tyre must have revolted yet again, and we read, "In my third campaign, I marched against Baal, king of Tyre, who lives on an island amidst the sea, because he did not heed my royal order and did not listen to my personal commands. I surrounded him with redoubts, seized his communications on sea and land," or roads, it says. I don't know why the translator didn't just write roads. They didn't have cell phones in those days. "I thus intercepted and made scarce their food supply and forced them to submit to my yoke. He brought his own daughter and the daughters of his brothers before me to do menial services. At the same time, he brought his son, Yahimilki, who had not yet crossed the sea, to greet me as my slave. I received from him his daughter and the daughters of his brothers with their great dowries. I had mercy upon him and returned to him the son, the offspring of his loins. Yakinlu, king of Arvad, living also on an island, who had not submitted to any of the kings of my family, did now submit to my yoke and brought his daughter with a great dowry to Nineveh to do menial services. And he kissed my feet." So at this time, perhaps around 660 BC, Tyre had a prince named Yahimilki, which I would translate to mean, "Yahweh is my king." That's what it means. And Arvad had a king named Yakinlu, which also contains a reference to the God of Israel. I just didn't try to translate it. I had to spend a little time in the lexicon. Of the destruction of Ushu, or the mainland portion of Tyre, by the Babylonians, after the Babylonians had already destroyed Jerusalem, there is nothing surviving in published inscriptions. There isn't even an inscription, a Babylonian inscription, describing the siege of Jerusalem. There's nothing. So our best witness is the prophet Ezekiel, who had written, as it is found in Ezekiel chapter 29, "And it came to pass, in the 27th year, in the first month, in the first day of the month, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, caused his army to serve a great service against Tyrus. Every head was made bald and every shoulder was peeled. Yet had he no wages, nor his army, for Tyrus, for the service that he had served against it." Evidently, the wealth of the city had been moved to the island before the walls could be breached. The wealth and probably all the people. The later historical records describing the destruction of the island city by Alexander, king of Macedonia, substantiate the fact that at this time, in his time, the mainland city was still in ruins. It hadn't been used since the Babylonians destroyed it. The Judean historian Flavius Josephus would later state that the siege of Tyre took the Babylonians 13 years. We only know that from Josephus, but he was citing older historians. And he dated it as if it had begun in the 7th year of Nebuchadnezzar. We will have an issue with that, because that seems to conflict with the chronology of Ezekiel, who set the conquest of mainland Tyre to the 27th year of his captivity in that passage in chapter 29, which would be about 7 years later than the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar. It would be like the 34th or 35th year of Nebuchadnezzar. But Ezekiel chapter 33 states that the news of the destruction of Jerusalem had come to him near the end of the 12th year of his captivity. "And it came to pass in the 12th year of our captivity, in the 10th month, in the 5th day of the month, that one that escaped out of Jerusalem came to me saying, The city is smitten." Like Daniel and Jeremiah, the chapters of Ezekiel are not in their original order. So the chronology of the book is not consistent with its arrangement. Both Daniel and Ezekiel have been taken into captivity, along with the 10,000 captives from Jerusalem, as Nebuchadnezzar had taken Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin, he's sometimes called in the King James Version, and replaced him on the throne of Judah with Zedekiah, who had in turn ruled for 11 years, as it is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 24. So the prophet states in Ezekiel chapter 33 that Jerusalem was destroyed in the 12th year of his captivity, which is fully compatible with the duration of the rule of Zedekiah as having been 11 years after the time that the captives were taken. In the popular chronologies, the fall of Jerusalem is typically assigned to the year 586 BC. By those same chronologies, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is typically esteemed to have ascended to the throne in 605 BC. So his seventh year would have been about the time when Zedekiah was placed on the throne of Jerusalem, 598 BC. If the siege of Tyre began at that time, in 598 BC, then Tyre would have fallen in 585 BC, while Jerusalem had fallen in 586. And therefore, Nebuchadnezzar would have had to carry on two major sieges at the same time, splitting his armies by a distance of over 100 miles. It's probably about 120 by land, which is quite unlikely. But according to Ezekiel, Tyre had fallen in the 27th year of his captivity, which would have been about 15 years after the fall of Jerusalem, or about 571 BC. So the siege of Tyre had begun 2 years after the fall of Jerusalem in 584 BC, which Ezekiel's date suggests, then that would be near the 22nd year of Nebuchadnezzar's rule and not the 7th. Then if the siege actually lasted for 13 years, 571 BC was about the 35th year of his rule. Since the chronology of Josephus is often unreliable, we would rather believe Ezekiel. There is nothing which we have found in published inscriptions which may help us to further clarify the differences and better account for the chronology of the fall of Tyre. Nebuchadnezzar II had ruled Babylon for over 40 years, until about 562 BC. I think that's like 43 years, maybe 44. One Babylonian inscription, which is fragmentary and undated, mentions provisions for Jeconiah, king of Judah, and his sons, and also for 126 men of Tyre. But that does not necessarily indicate that Tyre had already been destroyed, because Jeconiah was taken captive before the siege of Tyre could even have begun. In Ezekiel chapter 29, following Ezekiel's record of the fall of Tyre, the word of Yahweh avows that Nebuchadnezzar would find the payment for his service in Egypt. So in another fragmentary inscription, we read in part that in the 37th year, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Egypt to deliver a battle. Amasis of Egypt called up his army. And this inscription is very fragmented, so it skips a little. And it says, from the town Putu Yaman, and that indicates that the translators didn't really know which town was meant. distant regions which are situated on the islands amidst the sea, and there's some more spaces, which are in Egypt, carrying weapons, horses, and chariots. He called up to assist him, and then it's too fragmentary to really even read. And a note explains that the balance of the inscription is illegible. So it seems that that is when Nebuchadnezzar had gotten his payment from Egypt. Now we shall continue with verse 3 of Isaiah chapter 23. Yes, we will finish this chapter this evening, and the last part of it will go a little more quickly than the first part, but all of this history should be important to us to truly understand the fate of Tyre and some of the accusations against Tyre in the Old Testament prophets, especially Amos chapter 1, verse 1. And by great waters, the seed of Sihor, the harvest of the river, is her revenue, and she is a mart of nations. That's Sihor, and that's speaking of Tyre, of course. That's Sihor. Is a reference to a river or canal in Egypt, is evident in the first chapter of Joshua chapter 13. It's evident first in Joshua chapter 13, where there is a reference to Sihor, which is before Egypt in verse 3. And then in Jeremiah chapter 2, where speaking to the children of Israel in general, the word of Yahweh asks in verse 18, and now what hast thou to do in the way of Egypt to drink the waters of Sihor? Or what hast thou to do in the way of Assyria to drink the waters of the river? So evidently the Tyrians had traded in the produce of this region in quantities large enough that Sihor is worthy of mention here. These three mentions of Sihor are the only times that it is mentioned in Scripture. However, here in the second clause in this verse, the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible has the harvest of the Nile, and we will comment on that later. Of course, at this point in Isaiah, sometime around 710 BC, Tyre has not yet fallen, but the prophet is speaking in a prophetic past tense, which expresses certainty that the things which are spoken certainly shall come to pass at some time in the future. Be thou ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea is spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children. Neither do I nourish up men, nor bring up virgins. As at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. And I haven't really neglected the probability that sea here should be understood allegorically, but I'm not going to comment on it in that manner. Here it is likely that Isaiah had referred to his own earlier burden of Egypt, which he announced while walking naked and barefoot throughout Judah for 3 years, and he is professing that this burden will be just as painful for the people to hear. So now there is another reference to Tarshish. Pass ye over to Tarshish, howl, ye inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. Before the Roman period, the name Tarshish seems to have faded into obscurity. However, in the writings of the Roman historian Livy, Titus Livius, he's commonly known as Livy, the name of Tarsus seems to have been supplanted by the names of later tribes, the Turdetani and the Turduli, and I believe the Turdetani are mentioned by Strabo, who had fought wars with the Carthaginians before the Romans had conquered either Rome or Iberia. And we read something of that earlier this evening in a citation from Theodore Siculus. However, by Roman times, the region in which Tartessus was situated had mostly been possessed by the Carthaginians, and in its entirety had become known as Iberia, from the same Hebrew term from which the very name Hebrew was also derived, which is Eber, which Strong's defines as the region across, on the opposite side. And Iberia was on the opposite side, across the Mediterranean Sea, from either Carthage or Tyre. In the Septuagint, Carthage appears here rather than Tarshish. However, the translators of the Septuagint had quite frequently confused many of the names of ancient places and peoples, especially in relation to the Phoenicians. Many times they translated Canaanite as Phoenician, and that may have been true in the time of the translators in the 3rd century BC, but it surely was not true in the times of the ancient Judges period or the ancient Kingdom of Israel. The reading of these verses, verses 6 and 7, in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, seem to better represent the sense of the words of the prophet. So I will read that briefly. Oh, you crossing over to Tarshish, well, you inhabitants of the coast, is this your happy city whose origin is from the days of old and whose feet carried her to settle far away? And we would even prefer the reading of verse 7 as it is found in the New American Standard Bible. Is this your jubilant city, whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places? So in either case, the passage suggests that over these centuries, many of the people of Tyre, or even the wider region of Israel, had long been migrating to regions beyond the sea. Now Yahweh God takes credit for the prophesied destruction of Tyre. In verse 8, who has taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honorable of the earth? Yahweh of hosts has purposed it to stain the pride of all glory and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. Because in reality, in his eyes, and that is reality, reality is what God sees through his eyes, and the hell with the rest of us. In his eyes, although they seem to have honor, they were sinners. In verse 8, where we read the crowning city, both the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible and the New American Standard Bible have the bestower of crowns, which is the same meaning, but which is perhaps more clear in modern English. This seems to suggest that the king or government of ancient Tyre had anointed the kings of its colonies abroad. There is much evidence in Greek histories that Tyre had long maintained its influence over the colonies which it had founded, which we cannot quantify here. That would be another 10 pages. While it is debated by modern historians, it is fully evident, for example, that the Carthaginian invasion of Sicily, which had been held by the Greeks, was timed in order to prevent the Greeks of Italy from coming to the aid of Greece as it was being invaded by the Persians. At the time, Tyre was a tributary of Persia, but Carthage still had an allegiance to Tyre. Notice here that the merchants of Tyre and Sidon are the honorable of the earth, and that they are considered princes or rulers. In the modern capitalist world, the same situation has developed once again. And from the time that the monarchs of Europe were overthrown in the revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries, they had been replaced by the merchant class. These same merchants of Tyre had been in league with Babylon when Israel and Judah were destroyed. Although now they themselves will be destroyed, or at least displaced by Babylon. So Babylon eats its merchants. In any event, with the fall of Tyre, they are brought into contempt, ostensibly because their power and influence would be scattered. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more strength. And that verse is not very clear. Various readings of this passage do not help to clarify its meaning. From Breton Septuagint, till thy land like a farmer, for ships no more come out of Carthage. I don't know what land Tyre could possibly till. It was a fortress and a little island city off the coast. Then from the New American Standard Bible, overflow your land like the Nile. O daughter of Tarshish, there is no more restraint. Then from the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, cultivate your own land like the Nile. And that's not possible. I mean, they had no land. O daughter of Tarshish, for there is no longer a harbor. There the reading cultivate is from Isaiah, from 1Q Isaiah A. From the, I should say, the scroll designated as 1Q Isaiah A, where a note states that another witness in 1Q, I'm sorry, 4Q Isaiah C has the words pass through, just as we read in the King James Version. Pass through thy land as a river. Perhaps this is a play on words, as the people, or ships, have been described as passing through the seas, and the people were closely associated, I'm sorry, I can't talk, the people were closely associated with seafaring. They were mariners. They were a maritime culture. Pass through your land as you would pass through a river seems to be an appropriate interpretation. The translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible had clearly overused references to the Nile, which are only fitting within the context of ancient Egypt, where the only river was the Nile. So in that narrow sense, the word for river could mean Nile. However, this is Tyre and not Egypt, so it should be river and not Nile. O daughter of Tarshish, Tyre was enriched by its merchant trade, and her ships have been called the ships of Tarshish from ancient times. Perhaps that was because that was a part of the regular trade routes. So the term seems to be used pejoratively here. Daughter of Tarshish, like calling a modern American woman a daughter of Walmart, perhaps, or a daughter of Mary Kay. How about that? There is no more strength. The word for strength, or mazak, is literally a belt, or as Strong's defines it, or a girdle, as it is defined by Brown Driver Briggs. Here we would rather interpret it allegorically, as a defense, as something which girds. Tyre, having been an Israelite city, Yahweh is its defense. Pass through thy land as a ship navigates a river, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more defense. Tyre, having been an Israelite city, Yahweh is its defense, and now he declares that the city has no defense, so it shall fall. That's how the verse should have been interpreted by all of those other interpreters. Thus we read, he stretched out his hand over the sea. He shook the kingdoms. Yahweh has given a commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. The first clause here forebodes ominously in reference to the Phoenician settlements abroad, warning them that they shall not escape the judgment of Yahweh. Although there are other words which may mean merchant, the word Canaan had evidently also been used to describe a merchant, such as in Proverbs chapter 31, where we read, she maketh fine linen and sells it, and delivers girdles unto the merchant. Funny that that also has the word for girdles. So here, Canaan is translated as merchant. While in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, the clause reads, the Lord, as they translated Yahweh, the Lord has given orders concerning Canaan to destroy her fortresses. It seems that where Canaan, the land of Israel, is referred to as Canaan, that is also a pejorative. Just as Isaiah had described the Judahites who would flee to Egypt by saying that in that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to Yahweh of hosts. Hebrew was the language of Canaan because Israel had occupied the land of Canaan, and so it is here. Everywhere else that Tyre is described as a merchant city, other words are used, such as Kashar, which is a merchant, or Rakal, which is also a merchant. Verse 12, Isaiah chapter 23. And he said, thou shalt no more rejoice, O thou oppressed virgin, daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Kittim, there also shalt thou have no rest. And this continues the warnings to the overseas settlements, which had begun in verse 11, that the Tyrians would not have rest even if they depart to dwell in countries across the sea. Just as Tyre was called the daughter of Tarshish as a pejorative, because trade with Tarshish was its source of wealth, here it is called a daughter of Sidon, pejoratively. And perhaps because Sidon was more closely associated with Canaanites, because of the Canaanite influences on its people. That is also apparently why the fortresses of Tyre were called after the name of Canaan in the preceding verse. However, all of this has also served him, or served Yahweh in another way, because in the time of their punishment, his people were to forget from whence they came. They were to be blinded. Now there is a curious statement in reference to the Chaldeans. Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not, till the Assyrian founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof. They raised up the palaces thereof, and he brought it to ruin. This passage makes very little sense in the manner in which it was translated. What did the Assyrians found for the Chaldeans? Or who brought what to ruin? This translation is terrible. And yes, I do look at the Hebrew to every passage I comment on. Almost. Every passage where I comment about the language, at least. The Dead Sea Scrolls Bible has verse 13 to say, look at the land of the Chaldeans. This is the people. It was not Assyria. They made Tyre a place for desert creatures or demons, and they offer that alternate translation. They erect her siege towers. They stripped her palaces, they made her a ruin. I'm sorry, they erected her siege towers. So this verse is prophesying that it would be the Babylonians and not the Assyrians who would destroy Tyre. And this is also yet another prophecy of the Babylonian Empire, which was not yet an empire at the time when Isaiah had written. It would be another 100 years. At this time, Babylon remains a subject state of the Assyrians. So this is simply telling us that it's not going to be the Assyrians that destroyed Tyre. It's going to be the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. How, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And it shall come to pass that in that day, the Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as a harlot. The number of years which Tyre would be forgotten is the same number which was prophesied for Jerusalem to lay desolate after its destruction, which is evident in Jeremiah chapter 25. And while the interpretation of that passage is debated, Daniel corroborated its meaning for us in Daniel chapter 9. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of Yahweh came to the prophet Jeremiah, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. History also corroborates Jeremiah. As Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BC, and the building of the Second Temple was conducted from 520 BC and completed in 516 BC. So it was exactly 70 years from the destruction of the First Temple to the opening of the Second. Take a harp. Go about the city. Thou harlot that has been forgotten. Make sweet melody. Sing many songs that thou mayest be remembered. Tyre shall sing as a harlot. Once again, the prophecy elucidates the identity of the Tyrians as the children of Israel, who are accused of harlotry throughout the words of the prophets because of their desire for trading with the enemies of Yahweh, the surrounding pagan nations. So in Hosea chapter 2, we read, and this describes Tyre perfectly, "And I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. For their mother has played the harlot. She that conceived them has done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and my drink. In this very manner have the Israelites of Tyre enriched themselves, and now they shall be punished." While we do not have a detailed account of the period, because it was forgotten, right? Nobody wrote it. If Tyre had been destroyed by 571 BC, which is true by any chronology, then by the time that the Persian king Darius had begun planning his attempted conquest of Greece, which commenced with the unexpected Persian loss at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC, Tyre and Sidon would have been bustling with a marked increase in shipbuilding activities, so they were no longer forgotten. In the seventh book of his histories, Herodotus had written that the Phoenicians, with the Syrians of Palestine, furnished 300 vessels, and a little later, the Phoenician ships were the best sailors in the fleet, and the Sidonians the best among the Phoenicians. So according to Herodotus, Tyre was outdone by Sidon in that aspect. The phrase Assyrians of Palestine that we see in that passage of Herodotus was used by Herodotus to describe the people of Judah, which is evident in his histories in Book 2. First, where he stated that the Phoenicians and the Syrians of Palestine confessed themselves that they learnt the custom of the Egyptians, which is an incomplete understanding of their common practice of circumcision. And then again, where he had described the battle in that same book with Pharaoh Necho, which Pharaoh Necho had fought at Megiddo, which he errantly called Magdalus. And that is the very battle in which King Josiah of Judah had died in 608 BC. Once again, we see that the Phoenicians are Israel, as they had practiced circumcision according to the account in Herodotus. And he actually visited Phoenicia. He actually visited ancient Tyre. And it shall come to pass, after the end of 70 years, that Yahweh will visit Tyre. And she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth. In the Persian period, it is apparent that Tyre, the island city, had once again thrived, and for the next 200 years, until the coming of Alexander, the king of Macedonia, the Tyrians waxed powerful once again, powerful enough that they ventured to defy him and would not submit to his authority. According to Herodotus, the Phoenicians had furnished ships, the ships which Xerxes had used in his attempt to conquer the Greeks, as well as many of the pilots. For that, Alexander destroyed the island city for good. And the Greek historians had reported that he used the debris from the ruins of the ancient mainland city to build a rampart so that he could destroy the island, something which the Babylonians had evidently not thought of doing. But in the meantime, for over 200 years, Tyre certainly had committed fornication with all the kingdoms of the earth. However, in spite of that, in the closing verse of this chapter, we read, "And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to Yahweh. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before Yahweh to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. That the sins of apostate Israel are holiness to Yahweh seems contrary to our expectations. But evidently, Yahweh had used them for his own purposes, to accomplish his will in the world. So, in a time of Persian domination, the people of Yahweh, who remained in ancient Tyre and Sidon, would have had sustenance in the harlotry of their rulers. They would nevertheless be able to eat. Yahweh would have done this for Israelites, but never for Canaanites. But all along, the Tyrians and all of the original and notable Phoenicians were of Israel, and it's them who are being addressed here." This concludes our commentary on Isaiah chapter 3. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.